All right, today we're going to talk about stacks. As we'll see, stacks are a special case of the data structure linear list that we saw a couple of weeks ago. And we'll be looking at yet another special case of linear lists a couple of lectures down the road, namely a queue. Now, today we're going to essentially see what a stack is. We'll look at the interface corresponding to a stack, and then we'll see a number of applications for a stack. And then in the next lecture, we will see how you might actually implement or represent a stack. Okay? All right, so as I said, a stack is a linear list. If you recall, a linear list has two ends. Normally, we refer to the left and right end. Here, we'll give them different names. One end of the linear list we'll refer to as the stack, top, and the other end we're going to call the bottom of the stack. Okay. There are restrictions that are going to be placed on how you add and remove elements from a stack. And the restriction is going to be that both additions and removals take place from the top. Okay. So you can't add into the middle of a stack or remove from the middle or add at the bottom or take the bottom element out. Whenever you add an element, it is implied that the addition is taking place at the top. Whenever you remove an element, it's implied you're taking it out from the top. For example, suppose you have a stack of cups, or more accurately, a stack of cups and saucers. Okay, so I've got five of them here labeled A through E. Cup A is at the bottom of the stack. Cup E is at the top of the stack. If you're going to add another stack, if you're going to add another cup to the stack, then we're going to add it at the top. We're going to place it on top of E. We're not going to stuff it somewhere in the middle of that pile or at the bottom. Okay. So if you add a cup, it's going to go to the top. Similarly, if you want to remove a cup from the stack on the right, then the cup we're going to remove is the one that is at the top. Okay. So we'll get back the stack on the left. Our stacks arise quite frequently in practice. For example, if you walk into a cafeteria, you'll find a stack of trays. So you pick up the tray at the top. If you change your mind and want to leave the cafeteria, put the tray back up at the top of the stack. Or if you look at a laser printer, it's got a paper tray. Paper is fed from the top of the stack of paper in the paper tray into the printer. And when you replenish the supply of paper, you put a new supply at the top of the current supply of paper. Okay. Or if you go to a newsstand, you'll find a stack of newspapers. Okay. So you pick up the one at the top of the stack, so you're taking it off from the top. And if you decide not to buy it, you put it back at the top. Okay. All right, so stacks arise quite frequently, both in real life and also in computer applications. We'll see computer type applications in a moment. A stack is also known as a LIFO list. LIFO means last in, first out, which essentially says the last item added to the stack is the first item taken out. So in the stack on the right, F was the last cup added to it. When you remove, it'll be the first one removed. Okay, so it's a last in, first out list. Okay. Right, we can take, we'll take this data structure, the stack, and represent it or specify it using a Java interface, much the way we did for the linear list data structure. Okay. So the Java interface corresponding to stack will basically list all of the methods that every implementation of stack is required to provide. And here I've listed four methods. We could have a longer list than four, but those are really the basic or most fundamental methods associated with a stack. The first one, empty, basically tells you whether or not the stack is currently empty, has zero items or more than zero. Peek is a method that gives you the topmost element in the stack. Okay. So it allows you to take a look at what's at the top of the stack. Push is the add method. Okay. It adds an element to the top of the stack. Pop is the remove method. It removes an element from the top of the stack. Right, the method names here correspond exactly to the method names in Java's data structure or Java's class called stack. Okay. So Java has a class, okay, not an interface. It has a class called stack, and that class has methods empty, peek, push, pop, and possibly some others also. Okay. All right, now, you might wonder why the empty method here is called empty and not isEmpty. Okay. You think that for consistency you would call it isEmpty here or go back and change the linear list method. Again, we're sticking with the names that are there in Java. Okay. So it's just historical, has to do with timelines and when things were developed. So Java's empty method for stack is called empty, and for linear list it's called isEmpty. Okay. So we'll have the same inconsistency in our implementations. All right, let's take a look at applications of a stack. Okay. The first problem we're going to look at is parentheses matching. Okay. So here we're given an arithmetic expression, or more simply, a sequence of characters. And the sequence of characters includes left and right parentheses. The objective is to output pairs of numbers, which will tell us that the left parentheses at position 1, for example, matches the right parentheses at position 15. Okay. So in this example, we're going to index the positions left to right beginning with 0, like we did for a linear list. So the left parentheses there is at position 0, then we have a yellow left parentheses at position 1, a black one at position 2, and then an A at position 3, a plus at position 4, a B at position 5, and so on. Okay. Right, so what we'd like to do is output pairs of the form UV, which would indicate to us that the left parentheses at position U of the string matches the right parentheses at position V of the string. Okay. So in this case, we'd get a sequence of pairs like this. So for example, 2, 6 is this yellow this black parenthesis here is at position 2, and then this right black parenthesis is at position 6. Okay, so that says this left parenthesis here matches that right parenthesis over there. Okay. So I'd like to get all pairs of this form printed out. Okay. Now you may get an input string like the second one here, in which some parentheses are not matched. Okay. So in this one, okay, this yellow right parentheses has no matching left parentheses on this side. Okay. The parentheses at position 0 matches the right parentheses at position 4. I guess position 5. But this yellow right parentheses has no matching left parentheses. Okay. Similarly here, this black left parentheses here has no matching right parentheses. Okay. Right, so in this case, the blue parentheses at 0 and 4 match. Okay. The right parentheses at 5 has no matching left parentheses. The orange one at 8 matches the orange one at 12. And then the left parentheses at 7, okay, the red one, has no matching right parentheses. Okay. So we'd like to get this kind of output for the second input string. Okay. Right, the way we're going to determine which left parenthesis matches with which right is by making use of a stack. What we'll do is we'll scan our expression or input string left to right, examine it one character at a time. Okay. If we see a left parenthesis, then we know that its matching right parenthesis, if it exists, is going to be somewhere on the right, so it has yet to be seen. So we'll put it on the stack in the hope that we will later find a matching right parenthesis. Okay. If you see a right parenthesis, then it's going to match the left parenthesis that's at the top of the stack. Each right parenthesis matches the most recently seen left parenthesis. So that'll be at the top of the stack. Okay, so to repeat, we're going to scan the expression left to right. Every time you see a left parenthesis, put it into the stack, which means you're going to put it at the top of the stack. When you see a right parenthesis, it has to match the most recently seen left parenthesis, and that's going to be at the top of the stack. Yeah?
So each of them will be matched, each parenthesis will be matched?
Will each parenthesis be matched? As we saw in one of the examples, some of the parentheses don't have matching left or right parentheses. So the claim is that this strategy will help us detect this, or will enable us to detect that also. Okay. Okay. Well, let's take a look at an example that will probably make it clear as to how things are happening. Okay. All right, so I've put up what I believe is the first example string we had in an earlier slide. We're going to scan this thing from left to right, making use of a stack. Okay. So the first thing we see at position 0 is a left parenthesis, so I put the index 0 into the stack. Okay. Then at position 1, I see a left parenthesis, so I put the index 1 into the stack. Then at position 2, I see a left parenthesis, so I put the position 2 in the stack. Okay. Right, then I see an A. That's not relevant to what we're doing, so I discard it. I see a plus, I see a B, I forget about those. Then I see a right parenthesis at position 6. Okay. So this right parenthesis is going to match the most recently seen left parenthesis that hasn't yet been matched with anything. Okay. And that fellow sitting at the top of the stack. Okay. So the left parenthesis at 2 is determined to match the right parenthesis at 6. Once you've found a match, 2 cannot match any other any other right parentheses, so we take 2 out of the stack. Okay, so I pop it. Okay. All right, so I take 2 out of the stack, and I output the pair 2, 6. Okay. All right, then I continue marching to the right. I see the multiplication symbol, the C, the plus, the D, minus E, and then I see a right parenthesis. Okay. So that right parenthesis has to match the topmost left parentheses in the stack. Okay. So I pull the topmost left parentheses out. I create a pair, 113. Okay. Again, I can pull the left parentheses from the top of the stack out, because once a parenthesis matches a right parenthesis, it cannot match any other right parentheses. All right, so then I continue my march to the right. I see a divide sign, I skip over that, I see a left parenthesis, so I put that into the stack. Okay. Then you see an F, a plus, and a G, you skip those, you see a right parenthesis, so you pull out the matching left parenthesis from the top of the stack, and you output a pair, 15, 19. Okay. All right, then you see the minus, and you see then at position 21 that blue left parenthesis, so you put it into the stack. You skip over the H, the plus, the J, and you get a right blue parenthesis that matches the parentheses at the top of the stack. You pull it out of the stack, and you create a pair. Okay. All right, so you continue in that fashion. You get another one. Okay. And then I guess at this time what's happened is we have reached this right parenthesis here. So I pull the 0 out and match it, okay, and create a pair. Okay. So this time the stack becomes empty. Okay. You continue your march to the right, and okay, we are here at the divide sign. We see a left parenthesis. Okay. Now, if before seeing this left parenthesis, we were to encounter a right parenthesis, then the same rule would say the right parenthesis just seen has to match the left parenthesis at the top of the stack, but there is no left parenthesis at the top of the stack, which would tell us that the newly seen right parenthesis has no matching left parenthesis. So we could output the message no match for this right parenthesis. Okay. All right, so in this case, of course, that doesn't happen. We end up with this left parenthesis. So that's put into the stack. Okay. And then you march towards the right, you'll find this right parenthesis, and that would cause us to pull out the left parenthesis that we just put in, creating another pair. Okay. Now, the other thing that could happen is you run this technique all the way to the right. Okay, so we started here, we end up all the way here, and we finish. Okay. And when you finish, suppose there are some left parentheses left in the stack. That will mean that those left parentheses do not have a matching right. Okay. So once you've exhausted the left to right scan, you check to see if your stack is empty. If it's not, you pull out those parentheses left in the stack one at a time and print out messages saying that these guys don't have matching right parentheses. All right, questions about how this thing works, or whether it works correctly or not? Yeah?
I saw C plus D minus E. Where are the E?
C plus D minus E?
Yes.
Over here?
Yes.
Yeah.
C, D, E got three parameter, right?
This one here?
Yes.
113?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where is E?
Let's see. As far as...
Where is E?
What do you mean by where is E? I guess what 113 means is this one here, okay? This left parenthesis here is at position 1,
uh-huh.
Okay? Then this is position 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13 is this right parenthesis here.
Oh, okay.
Okay?
I got it.
Yeah. Okay. All right, other questions? Okay. All right, so as you can see in this example, all we need to do with this linear list of left parenthesis positions, okay, we need to be able to tell if the list is empty, so that's the stack empty operation. We need to be able to add an element to the list, but we always add to the top, so that's a push. We need to be able to take left parentheses out, but it's always from the top, so that's a pop. Okay, and I guess basically those are the three things we're going to be doing here. Empty, push, and pop. Okay. All right. Let's look at another example here. Yeah. All right, question is, why are we going from left to right and not right to left? We could go from right to left. If you're going from right to left, then into the stack we'll put the positions of the right parentheses. Okay? And we would basically get the same result, except that the pairs would probably be generated in the reverse order. Okay? Right, so there's nothing magical about doing it left to right. You could do it right to left also. Okay. So let's look at the Towers of Hanoi problem. This is probably a problem you've seen before in other classes. The basic description is you have three towers. Okay, and I guess as legend goes, somewhere in the mountains there are Buddhist monks who have three towers called A, B, and C. And in their case, these are actually golden needles. And one of these towers has a bunch of fairly heavy golden disks piled on it. The disks are of different size. Disk number one is the biggest one, sitting at the bottom of the tower. Disk number two is smaller and on top of disk one. Then disk three is even smaller on top of two all the way up. Okay. And according to the legendary towers, there are 64 such disks. Though in the computer science version of it, the number of disks is n, where n could be any number from, I guess, 0 on up. Okay. All right, so in the legendary version, you got 64 gold disks sitting on tower A, and for some unknown reason, they have to be moved from A to C. Okay. Now, moving them from A to C has to be done under some constraints. Okay. You can move... Well, I guess simply put, the towers operate as a stack. Okay, so you can pick up a disk from the top of a tower and move it to the top of any other tower. But when you're making this move, you're not allowed to place a big disk on top of a small disk. Okay. So you should never find yourself having disk one sitting on top of disk two, for example. Okay. You can only place one disk on top of a larger disk. Okay. All right, so the objective is to move the 64 disks from tower A to tower C. Whenever you make a move, you can pick a disk from the top of a stack, move it to the top of another. And you cannot place a big disk on top of a small disk. Okay. Let's try to solve a simple version of this 64-disk problem, one where we have only three disks. Okay. All right, so the way we're going to accomplish the move of these three disks is we'll pick up the top disk from tower A, disk 3, and then we can move it either to B or to C. Okay. Depending upon where you move it, you may have a problem completing the remaining moves. Okay. In this case, we're moving it to C. Okay. So the smallest disk is picked off of A and placed into C. Right. Then we pick a disk off of A. This would have to be disk 2. Okay, you have to take the top one. And, of course, now you don't have a choice. You can't put it on C because you'd have a big disk on top of a small disk. So that has to go into B. Okay. All right, having done this, we will move disk 3 from C and put it on top of disk 2 of B. All right, at this time, we're in a position to move our largest disk, disk 1, from A to C. Okay. All right, next we'll move the top disk from B, that's disk 3, to tower A. Okay. Then I'll move from B to C, and finally from A to C. All right, any questions about the problem and the constraints? Okay. All right, so let's take a look at a solution for the general version. Okay. Oh, I guess another comment is if you counted the number of moves, it took us 7 moves. Okay. Total number of times the disk was moved from one stack or one tower to another was 7 to solve the 3-disk problem. Okay, we can come up with a solution to this problem if we think recursively. Okay. So in the recursive solution, we start with n disks on tower A. Okay. And I take my n disk and really break it up into 2 components. One component has a single disk, that's the largest one at the bottom. Okay. And then shown by this triangle are the remaining n minus 1 disks. So, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to take the top n minus 1 disks, okay, that's these fellows, okay, and move them from here to the red tower B, using C as the intermediary tower. So that's going to be done recursively. Basically, what I'm doing is I'm saying, if I look at disk 1, and let me forget that disk 1 exists. Okay. If I forget that disk 1 exists, no matter what moves I make, I'm not going to have a violation with respect to disk 1 because anybody can sit on top of disk 1. Okay. So forget that disk 1 exists, then you really have an n minus 1 disk problem. So let me solve the n minus 1 disk problem recursively. And in the solution, instead of moving these n minus 1 disks to C, I'm going to move these n minus 1 to B. Now, once I've done that, okay, I have this configuration. Okay. Then I'm going to pick up the top disk from A and move it to C. Okay. So now you have this configuration. Okay. Now forget that this one exists at the bottom of C. Okay. The problem you really have is take these n minus 1 disks, move them from B to C using A as an intermediary tower. Okay. The fact that this one is sitting at the bottom here is not going to cause any violations of the constraints because anyone can sit on top of this one. Okay. All right, so the last part is move n minus 1 disks from B to C using A. All right, so we have a recursive solution which says move the top n minus 1 disk from A to B, then move the bottom disk from A to C, then move the top n minus 1 from B to C. Okay. So we solve two problems of size n minus 1, plus we make one explicit move. Okay. All right, any questions about the recursive solution? All right. The total number of moves that are made, okay, if n is 0, then of course there are no moves, no disk to move. Okay. Otherwise, we solve two problems of size n minus 1. So that's two times the number of moves when you have n minus 1 disks. Plus, you make one explicit move, that's the bottom disk from here moves over there. All right, so we get a recursive equation for the number of moves made for an n-tower problem. It's two times the number of moves for an n minus 1 tower problem plus 1. Okay, and if you solve this equation, that works out to 2 raised to n minus 1 moves. Okay. All right, so it's actually a fairly large number of disk moves that are being made. If you go back to a table we put up probably in the first or second week of class, about 2 to the n, we saw that computers running on algorithms that take 2 to the n time, if n is large, could take years, hundreds of years to complete. Okay. Now, if you look at the legendary version of the problem where there are 64 disks, so we're going to make 2 to the 64 minus 1 disk moves. That works out to something like 10 raised to 19 disk moves. Okay. So if our computer was making a billion moves a second, it would take 570 years for the corresponding computer program to terminate. Okay. Now, if you look at the program in the text, you'll find that the program is probably like 5 or 6 lines long. So you don't really have to write a program that is 10,000 lines long to end up with a program that could take hundreds or billions of years to complete. Okay. All right, again, if you go back to the legend surrounding these towers of Hanoi, the world is supposed to come to an end when these Buddhist monks complete their task. Okay. Now, assuming that the Buddhist monks only are even moving one disk per second, that would be 570 billion years. Okay. Of course, they're probably not moving it that fast either. Okay. Right, to get another feel for how big 2 to the n might be. Okay. Right, there's a story about chess. Right, so the game of chess was developed by, let's say, a mathematician for a king many years ago. And when this mathematician developed the game and presented it to the king was very happy with the game and promised this person any reward he might choose. So this fellow was fairly clever. He knew a lot about 2 to the n. And he said, well, what I'll take is you give me one grain of rice for the first square, and then you give me two for the next one, and four for that, and eight for that, and just keep doubling it. Okay. And the king, of course, didn't know much about math or computer science, and he just told his, I guess, wazir, go ahead and open up the granaries and give him what he wants. This guy's a fool. He wants, you know, maybe a dollar's worth of rice. Now, if you do the computation, okay, it turns out that the amount of rice needed at that rate would more than cover the surface of the earth. Okay. So, of course, the king didn't have anywhere near that kind of rice to pay off his debt. A modern-day version of this, if you were developing it today for the president, you would come and say, give me a penny for that square and 2 pennies for that and 4 pennies for that. And if you do the computation there, it works out to about 100,000 times the federal budget. So it would take the U.S. government 100,000 years to pay you off in dollars. So this business of doubling, it doesn't take very long for it to become incredible. Even when you get to 64, you're talking about very vast numbers. Okay. Right, let's look at a problem from electrical engineering. Okay. Well, this is called the switchbox routing problem. Right, so in this particular problem, what you have is you have a switch box, which is basically a rectangular area, and on the periphery or on the perimeter of this rectangular area, you have what are called pins. So these are electrical points of contact. Okay. The pins are numbered from one on in a clockwise fashion. In this case, I've got 40 pins, 10 pins to a side. Right. So basically what happens is from the external world there are connections coming to these pins, and you're required to use this interior region to connect together pairs of these external pins. Okay. So we might be told that you need to connect pin 4 to pin 17. Okay. All right, so we have wires that are all around outside. Okay, so that region is not available for you to do this connection of pairs. What's available for you is the region inside. That's why this is called a switch box. It really allows you to connect pairs of pins from, I guess they don't have to be on different sides. They could even be on the same side. Okay, so in this case, I have to connect pin 4 to pin 17. And to do this connection, I need to route a wire anywhere in this gray region. Right, something you can see is that it doesn't really matter what physical path this wire takes from 4 to 17. No matter how you connect 4 to 17, you're going to have the effect of separating pins 5 through 16 into one region and pins 1 through 3 and these other ones into another region. Okay, so the physical path this wire takes. Okay, I mean, it might have taken this one, but even if you took a straight line or you went around the border and came here or whatever you did, these pins out here, okay, will be separated from the remaining pins. There's no way for you to connect these to those without crossing this first wire that you put in place. Okay, crossing of a wire isn't permitted because these wires are not insulated. So if you try to cross, then you get an electrical short. Right, so in the switchbox routing problem, at least in the simplified version we're looking at, you're given pairs of pins that need to be connected. They're connected by running wires inside the switchbox in this gray region. No two wires can cross. Okay. All right, so as we've said, once you connect 4 through 17, then one thing that happens is that pins 5 through 16, okay, cannot be connected to any of the pins 1 through 3 and 18 through 40. So if you get another request which says connect pin 10 to pin 36, you're going to have to declare this as an invalid switch box. Okay, there's no way to do it. Okay. And that's the same as saying that if you do get a valid request, so for example, you get 5 to 15, that wire is going to have to run in this upper region here. Okay. And if you get a request to connect any of the pins on this side, okay, then that wire is going to have to run to this side of the first wire that you laid. Okay. But each net is given as a pair UV. Okay. We'll assume that U is smaller than V. U and V are pin indexes. Okay. So the first pair that we connected here would be given to us as part of an input which says 417. Okay. We could refer to U as a start pin for the net and to V as the end or finish pin for the net. The objective is to determine whether a given set of nets can actually be routed in the switch box. Okay. Now, the algorithm you use to determine if it can be done or not can also be extended to get the physical routing, to get the paths. Okay. But let's just look at the simpler version where I'm given a collection of pins, a collection of pairs of pins, so a collection of nets, and I need to determine whether this collection of nets can be routed in the switch box or cannot be routed in the switch box. Okay. All right, any questions about what the problem is? Okay. All right, so the solution to this is you start at some pin, say pin 1, okay, and you kind of move around the switch box in a clockwise fashion. Okay. So you look at pin 1, and you ask yourself, well, is pin 1 a start pin of a net? Okay. If it's a start pin, then we're going to put it on the stack. Okay. Because its finish pin has yet to be seen, we've said that our requirement is that pairs are of the form U less than V. Okay. So the finish pin is going to be seen later in our clockwise examination scheme. So when you see a start pin, you put it on the top of the stack. Okay. Now when you see a finish pin or an end pin, okay. So for example, here, okay, let's say we saw pin number 4 was a start pin, so it goes onto the stack. Okay. Then we're going to examine 5, 6, up through 16, okay, and we come now and see pin 17, okay. If at this time, suppose that pin 4 is not at the top of the stack, okay, what that would mean is that one of these pins in here is a start pin, and its corresponding pin is on that side, okay, and so it is an infeasible switch box, okay. So, if you think about it a little further, you'll be able to convince yourself that that is always the case. Whenever you see a finish pin, like 17, its corresponding start pin must be at the top of the stack. If it's not at the top of the stack, then between the start and finish pin, there are other pins which are start pins and whose finish hasn't been encountered yet, and therefore you can't complete those nets. Right, so to repeat, the algorithm basically is travel around the switch box in a clockwise fashion beginning at pin 1. If it's a start pin, push it onto the stack. If it is a finish pin, do a peek to see if the fellow at the top is the corresponding start pin. If it is, you can pop it off because you can route it. If it's not the corresponding start pin, you declare this as an infeasible switch box. All right, any questions about that? All right, so you get a fairly simple algorithm for switchbox routing, making use of a stack. All right, another example here of stacks is if you look at a Java program, for example, where I've written a method A, which invokes a method B, B in turn invokes a method C, C invokes a method D, D invokes E, and E invokes C. Okay. So something that the Java runtime environment would do to keep track of things so that you're executing these methods correctly is employ a stack. Okay. And in this stack, we're going to save addresses in memory that we should return to whenever someone does a return. Okay. So when you're executing the first method there, A, you come in there and it says, now go and do B. Okay. So at this time, in the stack, I'm going to store an address, okay, which will say, when you encounter a return, you come back here. Okay. Then I start executing B, and this fellow says, well, interrupt B now, go and do C. So at this time, on my stack, I'm going to put an address which says, well, when you're done with C, come back here. Okay. So I put a return address in B. Okay. So same thing happens when you're in C, you're asked to go and do D. So onto the stack, you save a return address to come back to in C when you finish with D. You're in D, you're asked to interrupt D, go and do E. So you save a place where you're going to come back to in D when you're finished with E. You're in E, you're asked to go and execute C. So you save a place in E that you're going to come back to when you're done with C. Now you're in C, and in C, you're asked to go and do D. So you save another address from C, which says when you're done with D, come back here. Okay. Right, now suppose you're now in D, okay, and inside D, of course, there are some if statements and things, and conditions are such that in D, you now hit a return. So you look at the top of your stack, and that tells you where to go. Okay. So when you hit that return, you go back to whatever this thing says in C. Now when you're executing this part of C, if you hit a return, the top of the stack says go to some place in E. So you go out there. Okay. So a stack is used to implement method calls and returns, or method invocation and returns. Right, they're also used in try-catch. I'm going to skip this one and go to the next example, which is a rat in a maze. Okay. Right, so in the rat in the maze problem, you're given a maze, which could be represented as an array. The orange squares in the array represent squares that are open, so a rat can move there. The blue ones represent blocks, so a rat cannot move to a blue square. The top left green square is the entrance to the maze, and the bottom right green square is the exit to the maze, and at the exit is a tasty block of cheese. Okay. Right, the objective is to find a path from the top left square to the bottom right square. All right, so the rat moves into the entrance, which is the top left square, and now has a choice of either moving to the right or moving to the square below it. Okay. So we'll assume that the rat is consistent, and whenever faced with a choice, first opts to move to the right, and then tries to move down, and then to the left, and then up. So in this case, it can move to the right or down, so it decides to move to the right. Oops. Now, as it moves from one square to the next, the rat is going to block positions so that it doesn't end up moving to the same square twice. Okay. All right, so we move to the right. Okay. And from here, we again move to the right. Okay. Right. So we keep moving kind of one square at a time. And then you reach a place from which you cannot move to the right, you cannot move down, you cannot move left, you cannot move up. So this time we're going to backtrack along the currently active path, which is shown by the yellows. Okay. So we back up to the next place from which you can move forward. So sitting here, the red ones show squares you've moved to, but from which which aren't part of the current active path. The current active path is from the start to where you currently are. So that's the yellow one. Okay. So from here you can move down. Okay. And then from here you can move to the left, and now you can move down. Okay. And now you can't progress forward, so you backtrack on this path, leaving red squares. Okay. Okay. All right. So from here we move downwards, okay, until we come to a place where our priority rule said move left first. So until you come to a place where you can move left, say. And from here we try to move left. Can move several squares. And again, we are blocked, so we're going to backtrack. Okay. Until you come to a place where there's another orange square. Okay. And then from here, we're going to move forward. Okay. To the next place where you can move to the left. Okay. Well, I guess it's to the right. And we come over here. And then from here, we're going to, I guess, be able to go one down and then right. Okay. Again, the thing to keep in mind is that the sequence of yellow squares, okay, operates as a stack. Every time you move forward, you put the yellow square on the stack. And when you're backtracking through your yellow squares the order they are in the stack. Okay. All right, so now we're going to move forward, putting a bunch of yellow squares on a stack, so you move up and go down there. And then from here, we can move down, putting a bunch of yellow squares on the stack. Okay. All right, so in the rat in a maze problem, the way you solve this is you make use of a stack. In the stack, you place squares from which you have moved. This sequence of squares describes a path from the start square to your current location. When you reach a square from which you cannot move forward, then you move back to the square at the top of the stack. Okay. All right. Any questions about the rat in the maze? Okay. Now, for some of these problems, like the Tower of Hanoi and the rat in the maze, if you go to the website, there are animations that you could play with. You could input your own maze and then see how the rat kind of moves around and how the yellow path changes. Yeah.
On the left-hand side of the maze, it showed that it was like red at the end.
Oh, that shouldn't have been there. I'm not sure how it turned red because our rat never moved down there.
Right.
Yeah, that should remain orange. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Thanks.